Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus and streaming live at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today my guest is Meryl Marco. The show was recorded on October 14th, 2020. Meryl is a multiple Emmy Award-winning writer for her work on The David Letterman Show and has written for television shows such as Sex and the City, Newhart, and Moonlighting. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, Time, and The New York Times, and she is the author of 8 previous books. She was recently awarded the Patty Chayefsky Laurel Award for Television Writing Achievement. Her new graphic memoir is We Saw Scenery, The Early Diaries of Meryl Marco, written and illustrated by Meryl Marco, published by Algonquin. Welcome back to the show, Meryl.
Thank you for having me.
I love this book. I have to say, I've already told you, I can't remember the last time I laughed out loud at a book of any genre, actually. Humor is so hard to pull off on the page, I think. And I don't know, I picked it up again today. I finished it yesterday, the day before, picked it up again today. Some of the same pages made me laugh all over again.
Wow, that's lovely. Thank you.
Talk about how the graphic memoir came about.
Well, I was cleaning out my office as a comedy professional, which is what I will laughingly refer to myself as. I've been doing some version of comedy for decades and decades, and I save a ton of stuff because I always find things I think are funny, and then I never know where to put them, and then I put them in files, and I put them in piles, and then I have piles and files all over my office. So I was cleaning up, and I came to, at the bottom of a box, 3 little tiny diaries that I kept in grade school. And it was my first diary I got someplace in fourth grade and kept through fifth grade. And it was a Christmas present, actually a Hanukkah present, and from my mother. And the thing that really was important to me about it was it had a lock and a key. Like, when I was looking at it this time, I was thinking, what in the world could I ever have been writing when I was 10 that really daren't see the light of day, you know? And so I opened it up, and I felt the mission of a diary. I didn't exactly understand why you had a diary, but I thought the mission was write something on every page. So there's quite a few pages that say things like, nothing happened once again, as usual. And then the other pages, I didn't know what else to write. So I just wrote down everything that happened, which is very unlike the way I'd keep a diary now. You know, I mentioned what tests I had coming up and who, and what we were doing, what we did at Girl Scouts and what we did here and what we did there and who I was in love with and what my friend did and what friend came over and where I went over there. And it was such a complete listing of my life that I thought, well, this is pretty interesting, you know, like who the hell was this person? I mean, she wasn't really me yet, but she really didn't have that much in common with me in a lot of ways because she hadn't formed. So I was thinking, well, who is she? Is she me doing my mom? Was she me doing my friends? And I thought I really should just sit down and read these things. And my first thought was going to be, well, after I was reading it for a while, I should draw these. I'd kind of like to see, draw them non-judgmentally. I'd kind of like to see what it looked like for somebody looking at this kid. And then I thought, well, this might be a funny comic strip, just the diary of Meryl Marco. Today we had a so-and-so test. Today we had this. Today we did that. And then I started doing that. And then pretty soon I had a giant pile of these drawings on my desk. And then all my friends started going, I would show some of them to my friends, and they started going, it's a book. You need to make this into a book. And then I thought, it can't be a book. It's too random. It's just random stuff. So I started working pretty hard to figure out what overlayer went with this so that there'd be some reason for you to care about what this random kid was doing randomly. And so it's got layers. It's got voiceover layers of me now, and including there were parts as I was going through it where I would just look at this kid and I would go, oh no, oh no, 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 oh no, no. And then so I ended up drawing myself into the thing and going, what in the world are you thinking? I just felt I had to have a talk with myself. I was wondering whether or not I would have paid any attention, which of course I know I wouldn't have because I certainly wasn't paying attention to anyone else. And I mean, I was and I wasn't. I took authority very seriously, but adult authority was always a little suspect. And anyway, so that's how I assembled it.
Your parents provided a ton of material, didn't they?
Well, everybody's parents do, don't they? I had a kind of a on again, off again relationship with my parents, not a good one with my mom, which started at a very specific part of the diary. You know, in the beginning, when I was totally unformed, I think we were getting along better than when I started turning into anyone. And then that was too many people. She wanted, you know, her and then her. And and so that, so I put in the best of that. You know, there was a lot more of all of this, obviously.
It's interesting what you remembered. I mean, apart from the diary entries, you know, you talk a bit about memory in this book and how the brain picks and chooses what it plans to remember. As you started working on this, things must have come up that you had totally forgotten.
Well, that's the thing that was interesting to me is that I didn't remember a lot of it, and I did remember a lot of it. What I did remember when I remembered it was just a glimpse, was just sort of why I wanted to draw it. I was wondering what it actually looked like. But I didn't remember, like, it was sort of random what stuff made the journey through time with me. Like, I remembered a really horrible sandwich that we had on a trip, a family trip, which I wrote about. I was the early version of Yelp. I wrote about it at length, how disgusting the sandwich was. But there was a day that I labeled the worst day I have ever lived through. I will never live through a day this terrible again. I don't have any memory of. So that just lets you know, I guess it, yeah, it's weird that I actually blocked that one out. I would think that one at least would have been underlined. So yeah, you don't really know which stuff you are going to remember and which stuff you aren't. I did remember a lot of it. And I'd say I remembered about 65% of it. And then about the rest I didn't. I only vaguely remembered. And then sometimes I would think I kind of remembered it. But then when I was examining it further, I think, am I really remembering it? Or did I just make up a picture of it? Because I keep reading this page. So it's confusing, actually. Your memory is very unreliable, I'm told.
Yeah, especially when other family members experience the same thing. Or, you know, we're at the same place. And they all have different memories of what happened.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's sort of go back a little bit, because you spent something like 6 years in art school.
Yeah, I got a master's degree in art. I went to UC Berkeley at just the right time. I was really eager to get out of my parents' house and go to someplace crazy, and I picked just the right place at just the right time. It was one of the few right moves I ever made. My parents gave me the choice of any UC campus because it was extremely inexpensive for state residents at that point. It was like $75 a quarter.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Which you can imagine. But the only campus for me was Berkeley because I thought, where is the action? Where is it crazy? And that's where I went.
So your intention obviously was to be an artist.
Yeah, my original intention was to be an actress. But my mother was really against that, so I went in a different direction in the name of pleasing my mother.
So then when did writing come into things?
Weirdly, my mother meant to be a writer. This is just the way that this stuff goes, you know. She really meant to be a writer, and she had some early copywriting jobs and stuff. And she used to correct my papers when I was a kid. When I would write essays for school, she would go through them and she'd put copywriting insignia, shorthand all over it. You know, I don't, you remember that stuff? It would be like new paragraph
and, yeah, yeah.
and capital here and, you know, cut. And she would do that to my work. So I actually had writing training from her that way. I was kind of a good writer, but I never thought of being a writer, actually. I was writing some stuff, but I never actually thought I would be a writer until I got a job teaching art at USC in the, let's see, what year was that? That was like in the 70s somewhere. And then when I got to USC, I realized they had this big film department, and I got extremely excited because it had never occurred to me before, because they didn't really have one at UC Berkeley. It never occurred to me that it was a thing you could study. You could study screenwriting, you could make movies. That stuff didn't occur to me. So because I was a faculty member, I just audited all this film class, and the next thing you know, I switched careers.
So then you found your way to comedy somehow.
Well, comedy was really always going to be the only thing. I mean, I found my way to comedy pretty early. I think anybody who has that combination of ability and disability will say the same thing. You start out realizing that the one superpower you have is to make a joke. It's like a little girl who realizes that her whole, that one card she can play is that she's the prettiest girl in the class. You know, you realize the one card you have is that you can make a joke about everything, and therefore you can reclaim the whole topic as your own. So it starts young, and it has to do with a lot of weird, demented personality distortions. But it starts young, you know, I've had that for a long time. It was always the thing I loved.
Well, in the book, I forget where it was, but early on, it wasn't that early on. At some point, you're dealing with kind of the miseries of life as a kid, and then you have the realization that you're a funny kid.
Well, that was, I sort of knew I was, there was a period of time in junior high, which was middle school. Did you have junior high or middle school?
We had junior high.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a toss up what part of the country you're in.
I was back east.
All middle school though now, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Anyway, junior high is where I was trying really hard to be a whole other, I was actually always wisecracking through that too, but I was trying really hard initially to just be cute, like all my friends. That was the main thing my friends had in mind for life, was be as cute as possible, as often as possible, in an extreme level of cuteness as you could possibly have. And that really never worked for me the way that I hoped it would. So I started, I was pretty, hitting the comedy pretty heavy by junior high. But before that, I think just professionally cute was probably my only interest.
What did you ask me? What did I ask you? I asked you finding your way into comedy.
Oh yeah, that was when I was at USC and I was taking filmmaking and everything, every idea that I had was always about coming up with something funny. All my heroes in literature and in film were comedians and funny people, almost 100% men, I might add, but that actually didn't even occur to me for a while. That I just thought, well, they're comedians, you know. I wasn't thinking of gender as a disability because I was from UC Berkeley, you know, although there was plenty of that crap going on there, believe me, but I somehow was looking past it. Delusionally, yeah. I think.
Huh. It's interesting, yeah. The comedians, you know, I mean, gosh, I'm thinking Joan Rivers and who else?
And I never was a Joan Rivers fan. It seems wrong to speak ill of the dead, but she was generationally on the wrong side of things for me. Her material, and I was always really into the written part of comedy. I listened to it very carefully, and it was all this stuff about get the ring, and, you know, stuff like that. It was just, it was not speaking to me at all. I liked, as women went, it was way more Dorothy Parker than her. And then, or my favorite was Robert Benchley of the Algonquin people. I was real, mm-hmm. When I realized I was going to try and write something professionally, I sat down to really see what my choices were in terms of what writing there was. And it was the Algonquin people that spoke to me, because they were that combination of cerebral and silly, that the same as on television, it was Monty Python. They were that combination of cerebral and silly. And then Saturday Night Live had just started, and it suddenly looked like a pretty good option. So also Mary Hartman, which was a weird soap opera. Those were the things I was looking at as, well, maybe I can place myself in here somewhere. And so that's what I was aiming for. I realized you had to write spec material, and that's where I was putting my spec material, is in that arena somewhere.
You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI-FM. My guest is Meryl Marco, author of the graphic memoir, We Saw Scenery.
And by the way, I named it that because that was a number of times in the diaries. That's how I referred to everything that was not me was, we went to the Florida Keys. We saw scenery. The opposite of actual descriptive writing. It was just hilarious. It was just, there was more scenery. Nothing but scenery everywhere.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, I mean, usually, you know, when you came on this show before, and usually when writers come on, they read. And I'm wondering if that is possible with this. I mean, I'm thinking, you know,
you can't really read it. You can do a Zoom share.
We could, but we're on radio, so yeah. it's not gonna work. But you know, I think in a lot of cases for me, the text is funny without the pictures, and the pictures are funny without the text. And I think that's why the whole book I found really funny, because, you know, I often don't get humor. I mean, I have a good sense of humor, but reading it, so often people will say, oh, you got to read this novel, it's so funny. It's just like, I don't get that. Things never make me laugh.
Well,
books just don't make me laugh. But yeah, I was just trying to kind of dissect this book, like, what is it? And it's, I mean, the combination is just excellent, but, you know, the text works and the images work. And of course, your self-deprecating humor throughout is wonderful. So
it showed up in layers. It's funny. I did I was just doing literally just the diary pages to begin with. I had, I wrote down what it said in the diary, and then I did a drawing of it. Then when I decided, well, that isn't going to, why is that interesting to anybody? Just random days in the life of an 11-year-old. So then I started joining it with voiceover, which was me, the adult, telling you why we were looking at this at all. And then after that, the last layer was, I went, well, these people should be saying something to each other inside the drawings. And then I went back in and added the talk balloons. It was a jigsaw puzzle, actually, doing this. It was so confusing and so much work. My God, it was a million pieces.
So how long did it take? I mean,
it was years.
Know, going through years?
Years, yeah. I'm a pretty fast writer, and I usually hammer through a book. It's never taken me more than 6 or 8 months, and then I do a lot of rewriting. But this was there were technical glitches, because I'd never done a graphic novel before. I was working with a book designer. By the time I sold it, a book designer stepped in, because I just said, somebody has to help me here. I really don't know what, I was doing it on digitally and on JPEGs and stuff at some point, and Photoshop and so forth. But I had a million little pieces and I couldn't figure out how you stick them together, or it was extremely confusing. And then there came a point about before it was, I had to turn it in. I turned it in last February, I think, a point where somebody said to me, all right, the following pages are digitally, there's the pixels are screwed up. And then they gave me 1,000 pages worth of things that I had to redraw. And it was, oh no. Unbelievable amount of work.
So in terms of process then, did this begin with a book proposal, or how did you get the book deal?
I had half of the book written. I didn't, at the point at which I started drawing again, I mean, I hadn't done any art for decades. I just became a writer and I stopped doing art because I felt it was dilettantish of me to be doing more than one thing. So I was concentrating on writing and I was doing stand-up and so forth and other things. And I just gave up drawing altogether. And when I started drawing again, I was enjoying it so much. I thought, okay, well, I don't care if anybody buys this. I just enjoy writing this. I'll just keep doing these and see what happens. So that is what I was doing. And I had a big pile of them and I started putting them together. And then I, at some point, because one of my friends kept saying, you got to make a book out of this, I asked my book agent, you think this is anything? And she liked it. So I sold about half of it, and it was not at all as evolved as it is now. It was way more primitive. I do a ton of rewriting. And in this case, I also had to do a ton of redrawing, which added, but I do a crazy amount of rewriting. I just do. So
what's a crazy amount?
Well, I actually, in previous books, like one time I wrote a novel and I rewrote it so many times that I put it back to its original draft. I went around the bend back to the beginning again. And I just went, there's only so many ways you have to say things. You don't have to keep reworking it. I was replacing and with just and so with but, and you know, because it, for me, I don't know how it is for you, but for me, I hear writing is a musical thing. It's actually almost singing. So when you write a thing, it actually, and you read it back to yourself, having written it, to me, it takes on this rhythm of da 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 da, like that. But then if you put it down and walk away from it, which is really critical, I think, when you come back to it, you forgot what tune you were reading it to, and then you just go, what is thinking? It's so full of extra words, and then you can start rewriting.
So do you read aloud then?
I it depends. I did an Audible book 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, and that one you had to read aloud because you were going to read it aloud. So,
which one was that for? Which book was that?
It's called The Indignities of Being a Woman. I did it with a woman exactly half my age, and it's we just looked into the question: how is it that 51% of the population became a minority? And found the answers, and it's a horrible story, but we make jokes throughout. We're fairly funny, but I did all of ancient history, and she did the 20th century and the 21st century, and it's just full of grotesque history that we make jokes about. It's very dark. It's a lot of dark jokes, but it's I think it's pretty good. Her name is Megan Keister, by the way, and it's on Audible, so if anyone cares.
So, but in general, you will hear it in your head. You'll hear the rhythm, you'll hear the words in your head.
When I write, yes, I have a rhythm in my head, but then as I reread it, I stick with that rhythm until I go away. You have to leave your work alone to rewrite it, I think. Otherwise, you just make a tune that accommodates what you have. And that's unrealistic because nobody else knows what that tune is. So you have to get to a neutral place with it.
Yeah. So also, I mean, I'm not a humor writer, and I have heard humor writers say that that even when you're funny, it doesn't necessarily come out that way, that you have to rewrite and rewrite to get the beats right, to make it work. I mean, but
well, definitely if you're going to perform it, absolutely. If you're going to perform it, it's another game entirely. When you write, print, you have way more options. You can be low key and subtle to the point of, you know, because it's just sitting there too, don't forget. When you do live stuff, it disappears. When it's just sitting on the page, that's a whole other element.
So then, you know, the shows like Letterman working, you know, working on that show, would there be a lot of rewriting, or would the rewriting happen during the rehearsals?
When you're on a daily schedule with a thing like that, it's endless, you know. I mean, while you're writing something that's going to be on the air in 20 minutes, you also have to have something that's going to be on the air in the same spot tomorrow night, and later in that show, and later in the next show, and then there's the night after that. So what it always used to seem like to me when I was working on that show is, when I was a kid, there was circus acts on TV all the time, and one of those guys doing plate spinning.
Oh, yeah.
Where they'd spin a plate on a broom, and then they'd spin the next plate, and then they spin the next plate, and the next plate, and then they'd have to run back to the beginning to make sure that the first plate was still spinning. And that's what it always seemed like to me. You definitely have to do rewriting on the floor. You have to please a variety of gods, the host being one, and then the audience being another, and then it's very nerve-wracking.
I don't think I ever asked you how you started working on the Letterman show, because you were one of the creators, weren't you?
Yeah, well, I preceded the show with him. You know, he didn't have a show when I met him. He was only on a game show, and then he was sort of an up and coming. He's on the verge at the Comedy Store of being the big guy. He and Leno both, and I was doing stand-up at the Comedy Store too, but I was incoming freshman, like you would never, you know, hear my name bandied about. But he and I started hanging out together, so I started giving him material, so that's the way that started, actually. And then he got a deal for a pilot for an afternoon talk show, so I did that one with him. And then after that, he got a morning show, and I did that one with him. And then after that, he got the night show. So we had, by the time the night show came on, I had written two other versions of that show, each one getting more refined until we finally had some success and knew how that show worked.
Like collaborating, and you said that the book, let me find it,
The Indignity of Being a Woman. I did, you know what, I do, I like it way more now than I did to begin with. When I went from being an artist to being a television writer, and there was so much collaborating that by the time it drove me into stand-up, because I thought, well, I need to hear what my voice is. And then I started writing funny essays, because I felt like I didn't know where I ended and the show or the person I was writing for began, and I wanted to know. So, and that, when at that time I really felt like I needed to go solo, but having done tons of things by myself at this point, yeah, I really enjoy collaborating now. I don't feel threatened anymore, is what I'm saying. I used to wonder, who am I? What do I have something to say? How do I say it? Do I have a voice? And I've answered that question for myself, so it's way more fun to collaborate now.
Mm. I'm curious the difference between doing a graphic memoir and a novel. When the last time you came on, you came on for Walking in Circles Before Lying Down.
Yeah.
Nose Down, Eyes Up, two novels of yours that I love. And I would love to know the difference for you.
Well, the difference was, this was so much more fun because there was drawing involved. And writing novels doesn't come naturally to me. If I had my option, I like writing funny essays. I like there to be a beginning, a middle, and an end, and the whole thing wrap up in 7 pages. That's great for me. Or short films, I like that. Or script writing, I like that, because it's got a visual element. The writing of a novel is, I have friends who just take to it, you know, just Oh my God, it's the most fun you can have. You get lost. For me, it was agony. Whereas the fact that half of this was drawing was really fun for me because it's the other half of your brain. You know, you know that left brain, right brain stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So your left brain, for somebody who doesn't know, is the math and business side of things. It's the organizational chart. It's the part that makes things in a list. I can't even think of what the one best word is for it. Maybe it'll come to me. But the right brain is the intuitive, creative side. So of the arts, art and music are on the right side, and writing is on the left side. So for a creative person, the right side is way more fun. I always think of it like you could be, it's a little bit like driving. It's intuitive. You could be drawing and also watching something or listening to something. Writing, you can't have anything. It's just all keep going, sit back down. No, don't go anywhere. You're still in this. When you're drawing, you could be listening to music. You can be listening to a podcast. You could be watching television. You could be doing anything and you keep drawing. So that's a lot more fun. Plus also, once you've decided what the drawing is, it defines itself. It's got its own rules. When you have a piece of writing, and even when you know what that writing is, it still requires you to be hovering over it every minute, repositioning words or picking a different word, or it's just way harder. I mean, it's way more challenging for an antsy human being to sit and write endlessly than it is to draw. In fact, drawing is one of those things where I sometimes sit down and then you look up to see what time it is and it's 5 p.m. You know, it can just drag you along in kind of a stream, which is nice.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm thinking about that. It seems like my artist friends are more, I don't know, are happier, more well-adjusted people somehow.
Well, it's mellow. It's a way mellower pursuit, you know. Yeah. Musicians too. They just they start a piece of music and then they just are there in it, and you forget where you are. But I live with a singer-songwriter, and you know, for him, the lyrics. Sometimes he works on lyrics for years. You know, it's a whole other kind of challenge.
So, yeah, but you talked about, I want to get back to revising, because you said you had to revise drawings too. How do you revise the drawing other than just starting over?
The way that you revise, well, I've got to say, as a person who's been drawing since I was a kid, so I didn't think I would like digital art. The first half of this book I did in pencil and pen and on paper. And then I put it into Photoshop, where I played with it. And then I printed it out and did some more drawing on the printout and then put it back into Photoshop. I was playing that game. And I felt that was a really fun way to do things, and I was enjoying it. And people said to me, well, have you tried digital drawing? And I went, no, that's not for me. You know, I'm a person who likes a pen. I like a pencil. And finally, I decided to try the digital drawing, and which the second half of this book is done digitally. And it's not only so fantastic, but the person who developed it to begin with and made it as great as it is now, I use a program called Procreate on my iPad Pro, and it's got an undo button. So whereas if you have to revise a drawing and you do it the way that I used to do it, you'd have to start over again with another piece of paper. And if you screw that up again, you have to start over again with another piece of paper. Digitally, you just press the undo button and you just go back to before the mistake. It's so great. I never looked back. It's the greatest. Also, it has a million different pencil tips and, you know, that are all digitally recreated. So, and paintbrushes and some magic tricks too, like clouds that are just, it's a lot of fun, the digital stuff. So that's how I revise the stuff, is with the undo button.
Interesting, I had no idea.
But of course it was only the digital stuff that I had to redo, because I had done something wrong with the pixels. The stuff that was originally committed to paper didn't have pixel problems.
It's always something.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM. My guest is Meryl Marco. Her book is We Saw Scenery, The Early Diaries of Meryl Marco, written and illustrated by Meryl Marco, published by Algonquin. I love the, it's on 194, the Palo Alto Civil Rights Rally. I love that. Are you the girl in the poncho?
There's only two of us in that. You mean the photograph of the newspaper?
Well, you know what? There's two of us.
It's my dad and me. And it was the worst picture of me. And I was utterly humiliated that people at my school would see it. And I would be an outcast forever. Even though I was kind of proud of having gone to the civil rights rally, I was really far more worried that an unattractive picture of me had appeared in the paper. Which is, looking back on it, just thinking, oh, come on. Hey, come on. What's wrong with you? And of course, not one person ever looked at the paper in my high school.
So. Right. Well, I'm trying to read it, and it says one of the few informally dressed persons was a young girl wearing a poncho. Is that you?
It looks to me like I'm wearing a trench coat.
Okay, so you're right in the foreground. You're right in the very front.
Yeah, it's okay. We're the two people.
Yeah.
Okay. They're probably looking for hippies, and I was with my parents, and I was wasn't old enough to be a hippie or anything. I was still being dressed by my mother, more or less.
I love that. And then there's the John Lennon drawing
That's
great. And also the text is so funny.
Well, that was where I found a passage in something I'd written. I was totally obsessed at various points with having a boyfriend. I was very sad about, I hung out with a group of very cute girls and they all had boyfriends of varying sorts, and whatever that meant at that point, you know, it didn't often mean what it would appear to mean. It could just mean they said we're boyfriend and girlfriend, and then there was nothing going on. You never knew it. And nobody asked either, I think, unless they were telling you stories about making out and so forth. But I didn't ever have anybody, and I was very, very, very obsessed with that. And that what was wrong with me and all that stuff, I wrote about that at length. But then in the middle of all this, my parents moved us to California, which I feel in retrospect saved my life, because I was hanging out with a group of really shallow status driven kids in Florida. And I fell in with the drama crowd when I got to California. Anyway, I wrote this thing right on the cusp there when I first got to California before I had any friends. I wrote this long passage about, I didn't really know why anybody would have sex. You had to be really, really bored to want to do that. And we just said, well, what was that stuff about the boyfriend? How did you reconcile these things? I guess I felt sex was a mandatory element in the boyfriend-girlfriend thing. Because I was reading ridiculous teenage magazines too, you know, and Lord knows what stuff I had absorbed. So I was imagining, I was deeply in love at that point with John Lennon. I was imagining a conversation with him where I would explain to him as my evolved theories about sex and boredom, and he would agree with me. You know, that's another thing. I had a drawing that got removed from this book. I was always in love with all these TV personalities, and they were so much older than me. And I was just thinking, what if I had actually met one and gone on a date with them? That would be a 12-year-old with like some 38-year-old guy or some 44-year-old guy. Or what? How gross is that?
And what was cut?
It was a drawing I did. It's one of my favorite drawings, actually, but the drawing of me at like 12 or 13 enjoying a fine a lunch with like a 41-year-old television star. Because, you know, when you have those intense crushes and stuff, you don't really think about any of that stuff. It's all imaginary. So you don't really think, well, gee, he's not really in my age range. It would be gross in person, or John Lennon and me. I mean, my God, of course, he probably did worse now that I think about it, but or not. Who knows?
Who knows? But I love what he says. And you are the most fascinating girl I've ever met. May I call you Meryl? Oh, his face, it's priceless. It's great.
Yeah. And then, well, in your dreams, that is what I was trying to imagine. What did I think I would even talk to him about? You know, that song you wrote, that was good. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And I love the conversation with Jack Kerouac, too.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, the my heroes were all these awful guys. I to this day, I'm not that crazy about Jack Kerouac's writing, actually. I went back and revisited it. Mm-hmm. I just liked the spirit of rebellion that book represented more than I liked the actual writing. And it was really exclusionary to women, you know. I mean, upon analysis, women have no place in the world of Jack Kerouac. They are a non-entity. They are chicks. You know, it's kind of like the world we live in sometimes now, depending who you're talking to.
You know, it's funny. I went back a couple years ago and tried to read On the Road again. And I'm like, I loved it when I read it like years and years ago. But now, you know, no.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's not that well written. It was just apparently, it's like, as a person who went to art school, it's sometimes you see a painting and it's really not anything you want to look at, but it had a big moment for itself because it was a break from what came before it. And so it represents a change that nobody saw coming. And that's sort of, I think, what Kerouac was it was a dive into spontaneity and rebellion that wasn't being represented in the literature at the time, I think.
Yeah. And Truman Capote had a big problem with it.
Well, he was right.
He's like, that's typing. That's not writing.
He was right. You know, it sounds wrong. I'm sure if I heard him say that at the time, I would have forever thought Truman Capote was horrible.
I mean, there's so much in the book I love, so I can't talk about all of it, but the last page I'm going to talk about is 266. It was too late. By now, I've turned into a version of the adult that I would become, someone who buys tickets to hip events and then always wants to leave early. It's like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I went to, well, you know, I have a tangential anecdote that you might enjoy about that. I went to every hip event in San Francisco in the late 60s. Really, I didn't miss anything. I was so eager to be out of my parents' house. I went to everything, every touchstone. I went to 2 Ken Kesey acid tests. I went to Altamont. I went to 2 Beatle concerts. I saw the Rolling Stones a ton of times, and every band. I went to the Fillmore Auditorium as often as I could. I went to the first human being in Golden Gate Park, which I did not enjoy at all. It was too full of the smell of patchouli, but like I just... liked that I, you know, it existed. I mean, I wanted to see what it was. But when I went to the Ken Kesey acid tests, which I also really did not enjoy, they were loud, they were super smoky, someone stuck their hand up my dress. They were not for me. And I didn't do drugs even, but I liked the spirit of creative rebellion, so I was hoping to find it there. I didn't find my version. Anyway, on my way out, I knew I had some wall space left in my bedroom and I needed something to fill it. So I took a poster off the outside of the building. Posters were big back then. And I took a Ken Kesey acid test poster with me home, and which I just ripped off at the outside of a building. Cut to 2 years ago, I was on some show called The History of Comedy on CNN, which was just sort of tracing, with a lot of talking heads tracing a lot of elements of comedy. And we shot it in my office, so I decorated the wall behind me in my office, and I had a space, so I found that I had kept this Ken Kesey acid test poster, and I put it up behind me. And immediately after this thing aired, nobody said anything about the interview, but I started getting these phone calls from guys going, is that a blue Ken Kesey acid test poster behind you? Turned out it was a thing, you know, like that there were only 20 printed, but only like 8 were blue. So cutting to the chase here, I sold it for $20,000.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that the greatest story that ever has been? I mean, and also not included in this story was my mother, who said to me, get rid of that thing. It's disgusting. Why don't you throw that away? But I saved it all this time in a neat little tidy drawer.
Wow, and a collector said, I need that.
Yeah, that they apparently is a valuable item. So there you go. I was actually happy to part with it for that kind of money. I didn't really like it. And this person probably loves it. So.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Let's see, we have a few minutes left. And I wondered if there was anything else that got cut out that you couldn't include. Or was that
Yeah, there were various things. There was, I was trying to make sure that there was some, it's really important to me that when I write that the stuff tracks and then it reads pretty quickly. I don't like it when you tune out on things. So I took out stuff that was seemed to drag and so forth. So yeah, there's a lot of different stuff. There was a lot more on summer camp that I took out. And just so they were sort of sidelines, you know, there were things that didn't really build any momentum or anything.
Mm. Yeah, I'm curious actually, with when you're writing, what do you do when you hit a wall? What do you do when you feel stuck or lost or written out? Or do you not? Do you just turn to something else? Do you turn to art at that point?
Well, in this case of this book, this book didn't have that problem, which is why it was fun. Because it was based on my, I figure out rules I play by whenever I write anything. And this one was gonna be, I obviously have a lot more memories than the ones that were in these diaries, but I was gonna stick to just the ones that I documented because they could be proven true, even though I have other ones. I only rarely illustrated anything that I hadn't written about at the time. So that, I didn't run into blocks. What I do run into a lot that's similar to blocks, I do this on like a weekly basis is, hey, this is going pretty well, to this is horrible. This is a horrible piece of work and nobody will want to read it. And it's sad and it's pathetic and it's grim. And so I go back and forth like a metronome always about my work until somebody else tells me they like it and then I relax.
So you share your work often? I mean, does that kind of help?
Well, this one I
did. Quell those voices?
I started sharing it with a couple of girlfriends early on to see whether or not it had any universal appeal or if it was just me masturbating. So I didn't want it to be that. So I was sharing it with a couple of girls. The man I live with has still not seen it.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, it's gone so long that that I don't know if I'll ever show it.
Well, he's in it. He's in it early on.
There's a couple drawings at the beginning, and I guess I'm worried that he's going to have something to say about those.
So let's talk then about fiction. When you were working on your novels, what would you do then? I mean, would you share early, same thing, and get feedback to see
the novels? I was sharing with him, the man I live with. I was waiting until I had enough of a draft, and then I was sharing with him. And he's pretty brutal. I guess that's what he hasn't seen. He's pretty brutal. But I would steel myself, and I would just go, "Okay, you don't have to take all his notes, but you should hear what they are." So, that's not even what you asked me. You were asking me about blocks. I was, I was showing it to him because I was seeing whether or not, and actually the criticism he most often gave me and people often give me, which is my TV writing background makes me terse and my comedy writing background makes me think that a short setup and then a punchline is all that's needed. And I listen really hard when people say, I'd like to know more about this, I'd like to know more about that, and stuff to expand.
Right.
I'm the opposite of overly verbose.
I
tend to cut things down before even anyone said it's too long.
Yeah. And then you have to add in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's better almost to add in.
Yeah, it might be, huh? I mean, I do the same. I write short and then it's like, well, what about this backstory? And what about that flashback? It's like, you need that?
That's the whole trick. I mean, the difference between writing and just filling letters on paper is all of that. That's what makes the art is, do you need that? Right. The answer to that question, what do you need? And is it that?
What about short stories? Have you written short stories?
No, I've never written short stories. What I've been doing lately is just little comic strips. During the pandemic, I haven't been really focused on what to do next. So I've been doing little 6-panel comic strips. I'm trying to figure that thing out still, about quarantining and about stuff like that.
How is it for you? I mean, how are you finding this time? Is it more creative because you're stuck inside a lot, or?
Well, like a lot of writers, it's similar to the way that you live. You know, I've been accused my whole adulthood of being too hermit-like. So some of that came really naturally, but it went past the point of no return, really. I mean, you have to take stuff in from the outside world in order to, you know, you do get it on the internet and so forth, but it's different to live through it than it is to just be looking at pictures and commenting and stuff. It's, yeah, that, on the other hand, I'm used to working at home. So,
yeah.
So it's, in some ways, it's easier for me than, for instance, my nephew who works at Merrill Lynch and counts on going into an office, and he likes the excitement and all the interactions and all the social life and so forth. It's harder for him than it is for me.
Are there comedians that you like now?
Oh yeah, I love so many comedians. There's so many good comedians around now of every sort. Yeah, if I'd known that you were going to ask me this, I would have made a list, because well, a lot of them are my friends. And then, you know, if I don't mention them, then it's almost a sin, but there's millions. I mean, actually, there's so many. I don't even know how to categorize them. There's so many.
Yeah. Well, you know, and just back to the comic strips, I looked at your blog, I guess, and just love some of the stuff I'm seeing there. I was just there for a minute, but is that some of what you're doing now, or has that come
No, that before? Was back when the blog was a thing. You remember that? Uh-huh. I think blogs are not a thing anymore, are they? Or I'm not seeing any. It was a moment there.
I see a lot of food blogs.
Yeah, I find, I guess that's what they are. I mostly run into that when I have to cook dinner, and then I'm going, recipes, eggplant, and then you just get your assortment.
Yeah.
I don't follow anyone, so I don't.
Yeah, I don't either. Your book trailer is a lot of fun, too.
Oh, well, thank you. I really enjoy doing stuff like that. I used to like to make little movies and stuff, but you can't do, there's a limit to how much of that you can do just at home by yourself. That's a little solipsistic, I believe that's the word.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, I said I wasn't going to ask you about any more pages in the book, but I have to ask you about Mrs. Reed, because
Mrs. Reed, she's like my arch enemy.
On the front cover and back cover, inside covers. Who was Mrs. Reed?
Mrs. Reed was my, I'm going to have to look up. I can't remember if she was I think she was my 7th grade English teacher. The thing that I love about that drawing that you're looking there, yeah. I did that in class.
Oh, wow.
And I saved it all this time because I was really impressed with myself. I really finished it out to the edges, and it looks exactly like her. and so it was really good. And I'm really happy I saved it. I had it framed for years in the bathroom. And then the fact that it wound up in a book is just a totally great little circular piece of karma. It's just extremely funny. She was horrible. She was really humorless and really boring, and she smelled bad. She was just like a trifecta. I believe that's called a hat trick. She was horrible. She was a horrible person, and she hated me. And I hated her back, and I was plotting behind her back at all times. So
it's interesting, though, that she was an English teacher, and she didn't ruin you for writing, you know, because a lot of people I know who had horrible English teachers just ended up not being able to put words on paper without, you know, feeling like someone was about to torture them.
I didn't actually take her seriously as anything. I got the writing thing really from my mother more than anything, because when I went to college, I really didn't take English. I took art. Mm-hmm. And I would have taken filmmaking just right off the bat, but they didn't have that at Berkeley at the time. So I took art. It was the most creative, least structured thing I could jump into. And But I never trained formally in writing, but I feel like I did because my mother, you know, so she trained formally, and then she was really insisting on it from me, and I didn't like it for that reason.
So interesting, our parents, what happens.
She turned me into the writer that she was too chicken to be. She wanted to be. And then she didn't really like that I was a writer. I think she was envious in a weird way.
What would she say about this book?
It's hard to say. She didn't like any of my work. I have a lot of stand-up about her. The main thing I usually use when I introduce her as a topic is she, when I moved to Los Angeles to become a writer, she insisted I wrote spec scripts. After USC, I moved back up to San Francisco, wrote spec material, and then moved back to Los Angeles to try to get work, which weirdly I got very quickly. But in the interim, I was staying at my parents' house, and I was getting ready to leave, and she said, well, let me see those scripts you're bringing with you. And I didn't really want to show them to her, but you know, it was a little bit like showing them to my partner. I knew I was going to get some kind of a reaction, and it was nerve-wracking. So I gave them to her, and I saw her sitting in a chair reading them, and no smile was coming over her face. And I paced around, and I looked at her, and I paced around, and I looked at her. And then finally she was finished, and she put them down on her lap. And I said, so? And she said, well, I don't happen to care for them, but I pray I'm wrong. And so then I went and took a shower. It was like the worst thing you could have said to me. I was getting ready to leave. And then I left the next day and went to Los Angeles and got work. So between that and the poster, you know, that was my mom. She was just, she was really critical in a crazy sort of tactless way. Yeah. It wasn't even like at the very least, she could have said, you know what I would do is I would shorten it up in the beginning or something, anything that you could use, you know, just no.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. She, you know, as you say, she probably, being a writer, she probably could not show admiration, you know? I mean,
well, she was also a non-writing, she was a writer, like she eventually went back to school and got a degree in librarianship. She was sort of, she considered herself sort of a one-woman book salon, but she didn't really do anything, you know? So she could have, but you know, that was what she was, it was that I could have, but I didn't,
right,
thing that she was carrying around with her. And she was in a rage all the time. And I think it's because of that. I think she didn't do what she wanted to do for some emotional reason that she never explained.
Sad. But anyway, we are at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any last words or advice for the writers listening who may also be artists and are thinking about doing something that includes graphics as well as words.
Well, I would say there's some really great books they can look at that were inspiring to me. Are you familiar with Linda Barry?
Yeah.
So she teaches anymore. She's been doing graphic novels and other forever. And she had a comic strip forever too. But she's been she got a MacArthur Genius Grant for one of these things last year or 2 years ago. She teaches at the University of Wisconsin. She teaches art, graphic art for writers and drawing for writers and graphic art and writing for graphic artists. You know, she split it up into the thing that you know how to do, let's work on the other thing. So anyway, she has a book out called What It Is that is just this meditation on creativity and imagery and stuff that I think is so inspired and also such a beautiful looking book. I'd say read that.
Sounds good.
It's really beautiful.
Yeah. Meryl, it's been a pleasure. Always, always fun to talk with you. And once again, thank you for this book. I'm gonna keep it near so that when I'm feeling desperate and depressed, I can have a laugh at hand.
you've made me feel much better than I did before I started by saying that. So I really, really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. Well, you're welcome. Great to talk.
Nice to talk to you.
You've been listening to Writers on Writing. That was Meryl Marco. Her book is We Saw Scenery, The Early Diaries of Meryl Marco. And it's written and illustrated by her, published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Thank you for being here. We're here every week, Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time. Come back, we'll have more.